Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil Computer Services, and you can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later on in the program, we're going to be speaking to Cuban musician Victor Alvarez. I'm very happy now to welcome Deborah Tang. She's executive director of St. Elizabeth's Shelter here in Santa Fe. Jim Podesta, also from St. Elizabeth. And Alden Veniklassen, who is from Sunflower Market. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks.
Great to be
Thank
here.
You.
So probably many of our listeners do not know that St. Elizabeth's has recently opened a shelter called Casa Familia. Tell us about this new place.
Yes, we opened it November 5th, and it is for women and families, and we started very small with just a few people because it wasn't advertised very well, and so we, as people learned about our new shelter, it has grown, and now we're full.
So that's good news and bad news.
Right.
Bad news because
right.
We've got some real problems here.
Right. I think that the families and single women also were, the numbers are growing, and it was very difficult to access any kind of services before. St. Elizabeth's had a women's dorm that was only for six people, and then we had one room with two bunk beds for families, and that's all we had. And so after people try to access services and are told we're full all the time, they quit asking. So this is a totally separate location from the men, and so it really feels very homey and comfortable for them, and they're really liking being there. We, in addition to providing shelter, we also do case management and provide meals and those kinds of things. We've had great support from our community, including Sunflower Market, who is here with us. They have been providing milk and fruits, fresh fruits and vegetables for our families, so that we're on a very limited budget, so having that assistance from Sunflower really helps us a lot.
Now, you probably more than many people really see the effects of economic downturn at the shelter.
Yes. We do, and I think that there are some myths around who is homeless and that, you know, there's a lot of people coming from out of state, that kind of thing. But in reality,
you're saying there's a myth that people are coming from out of state?
Right, right. But the reality is that the women and children that are in shelter, the majority of them are from right here. We have a number of families who have school-age children who are working with the Adelante program for the public schools and having no place to go. And so they're being referred to our new shelter.
When people come to the new shelter, how long can they stay? How does it work?
Well, like I said, we just opened November 5th, so they can stay as long as they want. We're not going to turn anybody out in the winter. And the fact that we're full, then we have to maybe reevaluate that as spring gets here, because we want to, our goal is to move people into permanent housing as quickly as possible. And if that doesn't happen in a timely manner, and there are people that are out on the street that need our services, we may have to reevaluate that. But for right now, everybody who's accessing shelter can stay as long as they need to. But in that short two-month period, we've actually had a number of families that have successfully moved out, and then we were able to accommodate more families. So it's been good.
Jim, tell us some of the stories of people who actually are coming to use the shelter. I think it's important for people to know what are the circumstances that people find themselves in.
Well, your previous question about the recession having its effect, we've obviously seen that. This has been, 2009 was the busiest year in the shelter's 23-year history. We served more than 3,000 people. We provided more than 40,000 bed nights of shelter, and we served 45,000 meals. And this is at the emergency shelter, the three transitional housing programs we've had before, one for families, one for seniors, and one for adults with disabilities, as well as the new Casa Familia. But those three numbers I just gave, they're all-time numbers in all those three categories. So we've definitely seen an effect. And I think another one of the problems that the recession has caused, or one of the problems that it's exposed, is that we've had a lot of people coming to the emergency shelter who have basically been working most of their adult life, and they've lost their jobs due to recession. The job has disappeared. And if they have unemployment, they can last for a little while. If they don't, it's 1 or 2 weeks, and they can't make a rent payment. They lose their health insurance, and they find themselves homeless. So we've had a big jump in the number of first-time homeless people showing up at the shelter.
I know that St. Elizabeth doesn't provide health care, but you must come in contact with people who need health care. What do you do?
Healthcare for the homeless is right around the corner from our main shelter, and they've been a wonderful asset in getting people the health care that they need. There are all kinds of issues that are magnified by being on the street, which, you know, being exposed to the elements and those kinds of things. It's very difficult when people come out of the hospital to be able to recover because they can't get the bed rest, they can't stay warm. There are a lot of issues. And so we actually now at the main shelter have a room that used to be the women's dorm where we're putting people who are sick so that they have a place that they can recover. The money that we got for the family shelter, Casa Familia, was only enough to hire staff to cover 3:30 in the afternoon until 8:30 in the morning. Our goal would be, though, to be open 24/7 so that if a little kid is sick and can't go to school or can't go to the daycare, they're not out with their mom on the street all day. So we would really like to expand the services, purchase the building, keep it going year-round.
So you are in the process of trying to raise funds to purchase the building.
Right. So the building we're renting right now, and the purchase price is $315,000. We actually have $231,000 committed by Jim. It's the
Frost Foundation, Thornburg Charitable Foundation, and then several community members. Yep. Have made these commitments. And the reason we want to purchase the building is because, as Deborah said, it's pretty much filled up now, and it's not a seasonal demand. The demand is there year-round, and we don't want to, at the end of March, have to tell people goodbye.
Right, right. So are you having events, or are you just soliciting contributions?
Well, this $315,000 is like, I consider it the first phase of maybe a three-phase campaign. That's the initial purchase price. We're trying to raise that money first, because we want to, when March 31st comes, when our rent is up, we want to be able to own the building and not have to cast people out. So the first goal is to purchase the building. Second part of the campaign, we've got about $90,000 we've identified in renovation costs that we're going to need if we're going to have it this space year-round and long-term. So that would be the second phase. And then the third phase is we're looking to have 3 years of operating income, and that's about $233,000 a year it would take to operate this facility year-round, 24 hours a day. So that's a total of a $1.1 million. So you can see this first phase is about one-third of the campaign. And we're going to probably try to expand this into an overall campaign, but the initial goal is this $315,000 so we can actually take possession of the building. And the final thing I'll say about this is while we want to make it this longer-term campaign with the 3 years of operating is this $233,000 of operating income, that's going to increase our annual budget by about 25% to 30%. So we were trying to fold that into the campaign.
Right.
Since we depend, 70% of our budget comes from charitable contributions from the community.
We're talking to the good folks from St. Elizabeth's Shelter, and Alden Venneklausen is here from Sunflower Market. Now you're contributing food to St. Elizabeth's.
We are, and we'd like to continue to do that throughout the year. It just started with one of St. Elizabeth's volunteers came in and saying, do you have any extra milk? And, you know, it's something that Sunflower is always interested in doing. Has been since they opened, but, you know, going out and finding the right folks where you can really make the most difference is important. So we're excited about this partnership with St. Elizabeth's and Casa Familia.
You also at Casa Familia at St. Elizabeth's you mentioned case management. What does that mean?
Well, everybody who is homeless has a different story. There's a reason, underlying reason for homelessness. And so it really is about talking with people and finding out what's going on with them. There are so many reasons. And for women and families, it might be drug addiction. It might be mental illness. It might be difficulty in maintaining relationships or trouble just being employed gainfully enough to support their family. And so we just look at all of the various issues that are going on and try and address those, not by ourselves. I mean, we work with LifeLink and we work with Workforce Connection and all the various resources in town to try and access the services that they need or the support that they need so that they can be successful in moving into permanent housing. The goal is permanent housing, but there may be many different things that need to be addressed to get them to that position.
Well, Deborah, doesn't everyone has an individual, every person who comes into the shelter, our case managers work with them to do an individual service plan, so they all have an individual plan on what their goals will be, which is usually moving out and being able to live independently. And there's along that plan, there's several steps one takes. You know, what are we going to do this week? What are we going to do next week? What are we going to do this week? So it's a, you know this better, but it's a combined sort of a big brother and a parent-teacher relationship or teacher-student
coach.
Relationship.
Coach.
Coaching.
Yes.
Coaching, I guess is the word. And I think that's one of the things that differentiates us from some other places. I mean, we've been very fortunate having excellent staff and having some incredible success. Like this past year, we put more than 300 people in permanent housing, and just the emergency shelter alone, where you can only stay for 30 days if you come into the emergency shelter. But in 2008, for instance, within a 30-day period, 46% of the people who came to the shelter were placed into permanent housing by the end of that 30 days. And that's really a tribute to our staff's hard work. And the staff really knows. I mean, if you or I were homeless, we wouldn't really know all the facilities available. But you come to someone, a staff member, they can tell you what is your problem and this is where you need to go. We'll set up an appointment, we'll coach you along the way, and get people going, give them some hope, some inspiration.
Well, it's such a deeper paradigm than just providing a place to spend the night when it's cold. I mean, and it's so much far-reaching to provide life skills, to provide empowerment, to provide the ability to individualize oneself eventually, which is what I think you guys do differently from anyone else and really well.
Thank and
you.
I think it's important to note how crucial it is to have a paid professional staff as well as volunteers doing work like this. You rely definitely on both.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. We couldn't do it without volunteers. We have people who do everything from writing journal classes to answering the phones to preparing meals. So we definitely rely on volunteers for a lot of the services and then also unpaid staff that really has those skills to bring to help people move, transition to permanent housing.
And then people like Sunflower and like many individuals who are donating food.
Absolutely. Couldn't do it without them.
So, Jim Podesta, you have a fundraising event coming up.
Yes, we do. Largely because this has been our busiest year in the shelter's history. Obviously, our expenses were a little higher than we were budgeted at the start of the year. So the Sangre de Cristo Chorale has graciously agreed to perform a benefit concert. It's coming up on Saturday, February 5th. It will be at 6:30. It's at the Cathedral Basilica at St. Francis, downtown, and tickets are $20. And you can get those tickets either at the First National Bank, Cordova Street Branch, the gift shop at the cathedral, or at St. Elizabeth Shelter. You can come to the shelter. You can give us a call at 982-6611 to purchase those tickets.
So that should be a great, big, fun kind of midwinter event.
We're hoping so. They're entitling it Songs of the Spirit. They're having appropriate songs for our organization. And that's one way the community can help. Another is with this campaign we're having to purchase Casa Familia. Interested people can call the shelter to speak either to Deborah or myself or to get more information, because we're going to need extra contributions to be able to make this happen.
Do residents of the shelter come to the concert, come to events like that?
There may be. We're not sure, yeah.
Alden, Sunflower Market is relatively new in Santa Fe. You're just going to be opening up a new location on Cerritos Road in a couple of days.
We are. Tuesday, the 12th, is the soft opening, and grand opening day on Wednesday, the 13th.
Of January. So,
of January.
You are committed to not only being a company, but actually providing food for people who need it.
Absolutely. We provide, you know, we're committed to providing food. Also, we do fundraising events for outside organizations. We do at least two or three events a month, you know, Chili for a Buck, where we donate all the food and the cooking, and the organization gets to keep all the sales. And hopefully we'll get to do some more of that for Casa Familia in St. Elizabeth's, but we are open to participating in the community any way that we can.
So I'll give the last word to you, Deborah Tang.
St. Elizabeth's Shelter is really dedicated to working with people, and we have had a lot of success. 46% of the people that we served went into permanent shelter, and you have to really look at it, you know, how tough it is for adults who are homeless and how magnified that is for children and how traumatized those children become if they don't have a safe environment to return to after school or, you know, during the day. So it really is a need that we really had for a long time in the community, and we really want to be able to address that.
Deborah Tang is Executive Director of St. Elizabeth's Shelter. Jim Podesta is Development Director, and Alden Venneklausen is with Sunflower Market. Thank you all so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mary
Charlotte.
Thank
you so much for having us.
I'm delighted now to welcome Victor Alvarez. He is a musician. He is leader of the group Sabor, which plays Cuban street music here in Santa Fe. And he is featured in the documentary One Among Thousands, which is showing this coming Wednesday, January 13th, at 7 and 9 o'clock at the Jean Cocteau Theater here in Santa Fe. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having us. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Now, you were born and raised in Cuba, but you left at the age of 13.
Correct.
Not with your mother. You were sent away. Tell us that story.
Yes. Well, we were actually called Peter Pans. There were children that left, the parents got them out of Cuba to get them away from the government there, the form of government. And for one reason or another, kids could actually go out, but not the parents. So I was just one of them. And my dad passed away in Cuba, so my mom got me out.
Now, your dad passed away in Cuba, and
yes.
He was a supporter of Castro.
Yes, he was.
But your mother
was not. Correct. Yeah, and she was very adamant about me not growing in that regime. And she got me out. This was in 1966. I think I was like 5 hours old at the time.
Yeah, you were 13 years old.
Yeah.
It was 1966,
yeah.
And this is a tremendous shock to any young person not fully grown to suddenly be in a new country. Where did you go first?
Oh, it was horrific. I went to Spain, and I was met there by a priest, and I stayed with a priest there for about a year. And he found a foster family for me to come to the United States with, so that I could claim my mother as an only son, and Castro then would let her out. And it happened that way. I got to the United States. I actually got to the United States in 1966, late 1966, and my mom got here a couple of years later.
And where were you?
The foster family that I was with was settled in New Jersey. And so I stayed with them there, and when my mom came, we stayed there in New Jersey for a few years.
Now, as a child, you were already a musician. What yes. instrument did you play?
My mom was my teacher, actually. She played piano for name bands there in Cuba. And so I played guitar. She taught me how to play guitar. And violin and the laúd, which is a Cuban instrument, 10-string Cuban instrument, that was my absolute favorite.
Now, the laúd, what family of instruments is that, so that people can visualize it?
Sure, it comes from the lute. It's actually an Arabic origin instrument, and but it metamorphosed when it went to Spain, and then it had another transformation when it went to Cuba. I mean, we really messed it up. We put frets on it, you know, we made it flat, and you know, and but it's a fun instrument to play, and very melodic, but it's also very soft. And my friend Barbarito Torres, who is the genius of laúds, and I have so much admiration for him, you know, argues with me, why don't you play the laúd anymore? All the recordings I don't hear are single laúd. And I have to tell you the story because it's quite funny. What happened when I came to the United States and my mom finally came, we looked for a laúd because it was my absolute favorite, but we couldn't find any in 1968 when she came here. And there are no laúds anywhere, especially in New Jersey. Laúd, you don't know. So she recommended that I play the mandolin because it has 8 strings and it's kind of like that. And I wound up picking that up and started playing that. And I said, it's tuned like the violin, so I was there. I knew how to play it. And now I prefer it. I own 2 laúds. I had 3 and I gave one away. I own 2 and I don't touch them. I just prefer the mandolin.
So you play the mandolin, and mandolin can easily be incorporated into traditional Cuban song.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. In fact, when I was in Cuba in July and I played with all these bands, they were all pretty amazed about the mandolin. And of course, I know what a mandolin is, but they have never seen it really used the way I use it, with the tumbao and the syncopations and playing solos and living to, you know, with a mandolin. And it amplifies really well, so it fights right in there with all the other instruments, you know.
So you then were in the United States. Eventually your mother came. You lived in New Jersey. What was your life like here culturally and musically?
It was very difficult culturally because at that time in New Jersey, it was a difficult place for Spanish people to be. But also, we were broke as dogs. Let me just be quite frank about it. And but with a guitar, I had a guitar and the mandolin, I'd go out, and even though I was quite young, I could make a lot of money just playing places for tips and stuff and bars and stuff like that. But you go in and, you know, it's this little Spanish guy and people were not, you know, in the beginning they were saying, oh yeah, all right, let's see what this guy can do. But once I started playing, they see almost like a different side, you know, a different thing. And I wound up making a bunch of friends and they give me money. And so I helped, that's how I helped around the house, yeah.
And so then you decided that was your life path, that you would be a musician.
Well, I knew that, I think, from Cuba. I think that I was kind of focused that way from a really young age. There was no question that I was going to do anything else. I was pretty much assumed. I never remember discussing with my mother anything other than that.
So did you then go and get musical training?
Well, I did that in Cuba. You know, there you start. You know, my mom was, you know, a pianist, so she was very rigid, really, really, really rigid in teaching and making sure that. So I started solfeggio and theory I hated it from a young age. The musical was okay, but the theory, blah. And so I started doing that since I was really, really young, and especially singing the notes and stuff like that, then applying it to the instruments. Yes, but when I came here, she continued giving me lessons. Most of the teachings I've gotten music were from her.
So you were really family taught, and then you started playing with other musicians. Were they, at the time, you know, in New Jersey, back east, other Cuban musicians or Caribbean people?
Caribbean, yeah. There were a couple of young guys from Puerto Rico that we got together and we started a trio, and we started doing stuff like Los Panchos and stuff like that. And I love that stuff, you know, with 3-part harmony and just having a lot of fun in that way. I think that that music is so beautiful, you know, and still very rhythmic. So yeah, I started playing with those guys, and then I moved on from there with different people. And you know how it is in music, you know, especially when you're young. Every year is an adventure. You know, you go do something else. Opportunities come and you take them and you move.
How did you end up in New Mexico?
I actually went to Texas. Well, being in New Mexico is a wifey thing. It's not.
A wifey thing?
A wifey thing, yeah. I had no. If you had told me, you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, that I was going to be in New Mexico, I would have laughed, you know, because from New Jersey, I moved to Texas, and I lived there about 20 years, and I had a big band there, you know, La Express. We travel all over the world with that.
When you say a big band?
It's a 16-piece band, And, well, it was 15 and me. And so I had, obviously a horn section, and I really, really enjoyed that band because I got to do all the arrangements, and it was just a hot band. And we did a little bit of everything, but we did it in a Latin style, like even swing. When we did swing, which I love Cole Porter and his music, and so I used to do a lot of his music, jazz. Still had a really good Latin flavor to it. We traveled all over the world. We have floor shows, and we even played at the North Pole.
At the
North Pole.
The North Pole.
Yeah, in Thule and Sunderstrom. I forget what year that was, but I took the band up there, and we had a floor show of, because it's the North Pole and it's the Arctic. I brought some young ladies to dance Hawaiian music, a dance troupe, and a fire dancer, and we did like a Samoan thing and a Hawaiian thing. And
who were you playing for?
There were some Inuits, but there's a lot of Americans that live up there, and we had I kind of questioned myself what I had done when they greeted us at the airport with parkas that had X's on the back that are neon, in case you fall in the snow, a helicopter can find you. Oh my God, I made a mistake. You know, I think sunrise was like 4 months later. You know?
We're talking to Victor Alvarez, and the documentary is called One Among Thousands, meaning you, one of many thousands of Cubans who left Cuba.
Yes.
And now just this past year returned, and the documentary is showing at the Jean Cocteau this Wednesday evening, the Jean Cocteau Theater on Montezuma Street in Santa Fe. The DVD of this documentary also contains a CD of music called Three Phases of a Cuban Musician. And so this big band phase that you were just talking about is included on this.
Yes, yes. I have four or five cuts of that on there.
Maybe we'll hear a little track of that
now.
Oh,
that'd be wonderful, yeah.
So that was from Three Phases of a Cuban Musician, El Africano.
El Africano, yes. Yeah, that song, when I arranged that, I made the words in English, but still all the rhythm and everything is blatantly very Latin. Yeah? But it's fun because everybody can understand it.
So you continued your music through many phases, and I think one of the things that's hard for Cuban musicians, especially Cuban musicians during this long phase of political enmity between the two countries, between the U.S. and Cuba, it's something that Puerto Rican musicians didn't really have. They could always go home, you know,
sure.
But you couldn't really go home. And so maintaining that sabor, that flavor of your country, how did you do that? How do you...
What made it even more difficult was that the kind of Cuban music that I like is pretty obscure. The stuff that I really, really like is the really old stuff, and it's like the country music of Cuba. It's folk music, Cuban folk music, and it's a song, the real Cuban song, and the Nengong, which is very Afro-Cuban. And it's a music that you play in the streets. Well, that music was, now you can get it on the internet, I'm sure, but at the time it was impossible, up to a few years ago, it was impossible to get. So all the music that I did was from memory, what I remembered. And it was one of the questions, and that has stuck with me that way now, even though I can listen to musicians that do that now on the internet and certain shows that are aired. But you're still not sure if... I wasn't 100% sure if I'm still doing it right, because sometimes you hear one thing and then you do another. And that was one of the questions that I posed to a couple of musicians when I went to Cuba, a couple of the band leaders down there, Septeto Manero and a couple of those guys. And I said, man, you heard me play. Am I doing it? And I was so touched, you know, that they said, Victor, it's in your blood. How can you not? You know, and that really made me feel good, because I feared that maybe I wasn't, you know. I think everybody doubts themselves. Every artist always doubts themselves in some small way. And that was my big...
Right. Very much so. I mean, I thought it was very poignant in the movie when, on a couple of different occasions, you say, am I doing this right? Am I still... Basically, you're asking, am I still Cuban?
Right. Yes, I did. And you know, and the way they put it was so warming, you know. They said, it's in your blood. You're Cuban. You're home. You're home. And, oh, my God, that just really touched me. Inside, it was like two moments, two heights. Highs of the trip were when the airplane pilot said that we were landing in Havana. It did something to me inside. And the other one was when those musicians said to me that my blood was Cuban and that I was home. Both those were definitely the highlights of the trip.
Why don't we hear some music now from Septeto Habanero?
Oh, yeah. Those guys are great.
And that's music of Septeto Habanero.
Yes. Yes, Septeto Habanero, they're an institution in Cuba.
Yeah. Now, that kind of music really comes from not Havana itself, but from the eastern part of Cuba.
Yeah, from Oriente. But it was always played in Havana, but it wasn't accepted. And being that most of society was in Havana, you didn't hear that much of it. In Oriente, of course, you know, that's plantations and stuff like that, and, you know, things of that nature is much more rural. So people were really open to it. In Havana, back in the 20s, or up to the 20s, the song, the Cuban song, which is a Teto Bonero, that's all they do, and the kind of music that I play as well, was not accepted at all by society. It was looked upon as music of the streets, and they like danzones, the danzonete, you know, the more
white and more upper class types
absolutely.
Of music.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And Septeto was instrumental in bringing that forth and having it accepted. And now, of course, you know, a lot of people prefer it. So I'd rather listen to a song than a danzonete any day.
Yeah. Well, and then that film, The Buena Vista Social Club, gave so much international attention to the form of song.
Yes, absolutely.
One thing I was thinking about when watching this film, One Among Thousands, was that Cuban musicians are, I mean, they're certainly competitive with one another, and there's a lot of intensity there because the standards are so very high. But they're so gracious, and they're so warm, and they're so incredibly good at what they do.
Yes, absolutely. Well, you know, Cuba's very musical, and they're, I think, pretty much all the Caribbean islands are. I think everywhere is musical, except that in Cuba, you're focused in that direction, you know, with government. For example, when I was there in Cuba, I had gotten a scholarship to go to a music school. So that's not an unusual thing. If kid wanted to be a musician, then you could, you know. And
the training is incredible.
The training is incredible. Oh, yes, top of the line. Top of the line. But your education is free, and you're helped to go in the direction you want to go in. And music is not viewed as a pastime. Just, we call it, we're playing music. And so a lot of the concept here is that music is something that you play. It's a play. It's not, you know, you should work and have, you know, it's not viewed as serious. They're serious, you know. Music is very serious. And you're right. It can be very competitive, and there's that. But it's also a camaraderie in the music where no one really hoards it or, you know, share it. And people show you things. And it's assumed that if you know something and you can help somebody, you just do it, you know. And even as a kid in Cuba, most of the stuff that I do, that is the music of the streets, was taught to me by street musicians, by guys in the streets, and even musicians from other that would catch me stealing their licks. They would, you know, bring me in and show me the stuff, you know.
It's funny that you use the term, because you use this in the film, stealing. It's like, you know, is there such a thing as stealing music in a
sure.
society where it's people are so open and giving to each other musically?
Well, if they don't give it to you, you're stealing it. So, and so what I would do is, as a kid, I would stand outside establishments and see what they were doing, and then go mimic it. And copy those licks. So they wouldn't have cared. I mean, you know, but I certainly didn't ask.
Right.
So I call it stealing. But in reality, I should say borrow. I was planning on giving them back.
Well, and the other thing that's very striking is that whereas, you know, here in this country at this point, we're really almost choked by commercialism and commercial space. There's almost no place you can stand that's non-commercial outside of your own house.
Yeah.
There's no commerce there. And although that's not great for the economy in Cuba, socially and musically, it creates this incredible openness and cultural space for things to happen.
Yes, you're absolutely right. And if you look back, even the visual arts in Cuba a few years back, I think it's changing and you can see it, but we can correlate it to the visual arts in that artists were painting things not for money. It wasn't a commercial thing because it wasn't going to sell anywhere. It was going to hang in their house or a friend's house. This great painting or sculpture was not going to be sold. So they did it without the commercial aspect to it. And it's different. You can see the difference because they were really doing what they wanted to do. You can't help. So now going back to music, you can hear the same thing. Musicians in that era were playing. The music that was being written was really for the people and not in a commercial vein, because they were not going to make any money from it, you know. Now, of course, that's changing, but it's really funny to see how, because that happens to me even when I write a song, I'm thinking about how is that going to go over. It's so it hinders you from really putting in what you have inside, because you're thinking of, oh man, is this going to be like this? Is this going to be accepted? Is this hit? Is this something that people are going to think is cool? You know, rather than, gee, this is how I really feel. You know, you got to be very conscious of that, I think, when you write and paint. Make sure that you do it for what's in your soul. Fortunately, commercialism is part of reality. You know, we gotta eat. So
we're talking to Victor Alvarez, and he's the musician leader of the group Sabor. Now, in the DVD, as we talked about before, One Among Thousands, the film that's going to be screening on Wednesday, you have a disc called Three Phases of a Cuban Musician. Now, we played the first phase a little while ago. What was the second phase?
The second phase was a madness that I went through there for a while in an acoustic vein. I wanted to do everything acoustic, and if I amplified it, I got equipment that amplified the acoustics specifically and not made it sound electric. And so in that phase, I did a lot of things with vocal harmonies and instrumental harmonies and with all acoustic instruments and the blend of steel strings with nylon strings and the upright bass. I insisted on using gut strings. Just a madness, you know, just silliness that one goes through.
Why do you say it's silliness?
Well, because it is kind of silly, you know. So what? I mean, at the end of the day, so what? You know, it's all about the music. But you get these things in your head about that it has to be so. You know, it just has to be.
Well, it's like people playing chamber music on the original instruments.
Okay. Yes. Right. Exactly. Yeah. That's exactly right. That's what it is.
Yeah. And then you know that has its. So let's hear a clip from one of those.
Oh, terrific! Yeah.
And that was Media Vuelta. We're talking to Victor Alvarez. That was phase two of the three phases of Cuban music. What's phase three?
Phase three is what we're doing now and what Sabor is doing, the street music. And so I recorded specifically for this some of Ernesto Lecuona, Cuban icon, two of his songs. And also a compilation of songs of the streets that I made into one song, and it fits quite nicely. But it's a real, real, real street song, you know, and that you do at the bembes, you know, or the gatherings, musical gatherings of the streets, you know, very informal, but. You can close your eyes and you think you're there, all right? I do, anyway.
Right, right. So we're going to hear that in just a moment. But okay. Before we go, I want to ask you about your life now. So you went back to Cuba for the first time since you were 13 years old. Yes. This past year, 2009.
Yep.
You brought folks with you who were following you around with a camera, and so yeah. All these encounters with Septeto Banero and the vocalist Ostagia and yeah. various people you met on the street and played music with, and friends and family whom you met there are all recorded in this documentary.
Yes.
It's very sweet and in many places. Now you're back.
Right.
What's it like? Do you feel the need now to go back to Cuba and recharge your batteries musically and familially and culturally and so on?
Yes. I think that, and this is probably true for most anyone that's been in exile or has been away from their home and they can go back. You know, I've always said, even before I went back to Cuba, I would say that when you're Cuban, you're born with an invisible sea on your forehead. And I proved that to myself when I went back, and I know that I will eventually live there, go back to live there. In the meantime, I'm fortunate that the Cuban government really likes this DVD and is going to be entered in 5 festivals in Cuba.
Is that right?
Yeah. So I'm hoping to go back there culturally, which I'll be able to do. And yes, recharge my battery and be there. And I think that the day will come, and I'll work towards that I can actually go back and live there. Exile is hard. I believe that there are several phases of punishment. And I think that the first one, of course, is capital punishment, but the second one has to be exile. It has to be. As I said in the film, and it's very true, I owe a lot to the U.S., a lot. I am who I am today because of being here. And I'm happy of who I am. But there's just something about Cuba and something about being there and something about being in your land with people that understand you so well, and a lot of different aspects, from religion to the food to just the mannerism and things of that nature that are so important. They feed your soul, and the climate, the sea air, everything. And so I think that when I get older, I'll wind up there.
And meanwhile, you are here in Santa Fe,
yeah.
playing the music, playing with the musical group Sabor,
yes.
and you play around town, and people go to both listen and to dance.
Yes, right, absolutely. Yeah, we have a lot of friends, and man, people love to come out and dance to it, and we visit, and that's one of the things. You know, it's a tough thing. What do you do with all your friends? You know. If I leave, so that's why I said when I get older, because I think that right now I would love to be in Cuba, but I would hate to miss out on the friendships that I have here.
Victor Alvarez is in the film One Among Thousands, which is screening at the Jean Cocteau Theater on Montezuma Street in Santa Fe this coming Wednesday, January 13th. At 7 and again at 9 o'clock. And the tickets are very inexpensive. They're available at the door. You can also get them at the Lenzic, 988-1234. And the proceeds will go to an organization that you guys support, which is First Hand Aid.
First Hand Aid, yes. Those guys are tremendous. What they do is they bring medicine into Cuba, and prescription medicines and non-prescription medicines and just supplies and things of that nature. Which is needed there right now. So I really want to help those guys as much as I can.
Victor Alvarez, thank you so much for being with us.
Man, what an honor. Thank you so much, Carlota.
And we're going to go out with the third phase of your Cuban music.
Thank you. ¿Dónde? ¿Dónde estabas tú? ¿Dónde? ¿Dónde estabas tú? ¿Dónde? ¿Dónde estabas tú? ¿Dónde? ¿Dónde estabas tú?
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Santa Fe's .foil computer services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. And if you go to santafe.radiocafe.org, you can not only hear the show, but you can post comments and tell us what you think of the program. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, the Colors of Jazz.